I'm going to run through a few credit derivatives, and we might like to keep in mind this classification that I've got here. First of all, there's credit derivatives, the simplest sort, that have no dependence on default correlation. By default correlation, I mean the tendency of two different companies to default at the same time. Okay, they have no dependency on that. So there's really, so what we mean is there's really only one company involved. And there's no optionality. Then we can go to the category where there's some dependence on default correlation, but there's still no optionality. And I'll be giving an example there. Then we can go on to a situation where there's optionality, but no dependence on default correlation. I'll be giving an example there. And finally, I won't be saying too much about this fourth category. It hasn't really got going yet, but where there's both optionality and dependence on default correlation. So the two things that you're sort of looking for in terms of levels of complication as far as credit derivatives are concerned is whether there's any optionality and whether there's default correlation is an issue. So the simplest instrument, and you'll be hearing a lot about this evening, are credit default swaps. What is a credit default swap? It's an instrument where there's a buyer and a seller, and the buyer acquires protection against the default by a particular company or sovereign entity. And we call the underlying company the reference entity. So basically, there's some reference entity. It could be Brazil, could be the Ford Motor Company, and it could be, you know, literally hundreds of these reference entities on which credit default swaps trade. And what we're doing is the buyer of a credit default swap is buying insurance against that particular entity defaulting on its obligations. So here's an example of a deal. You pay a premium of 90 basis points per year for a $10 million of protection, 5-year protection on the Ford Motor Company. So the critical thing is, how much are you paying? That's 90 basis points per year. That's kind of like your house insurance premium. Okay. For $10 million of 5-year protection, so what does that mean? That means you pay, I think it's $90,000 a year, 90 basis points on $10 million, and you pay that for 5 years. And most of the time, as with house insurance, you pay it and you get nothing in return. But every so often, of course, you'll find that you've bought protection against the company that defaults, and then you get a big payoff. And if there's a default, the buyer has the right to sell a certain amount of a bond issued by the Ford Motor Company for its face value. Actually, sometimes it's settled in that way, sometimes it's settled by cash, but it really doesn't make any difference in terms of the benefit the buyer gets. Basically, what we're trying to do is to make the buyer whole if the buyer had owned bonds issued by the reference entity, which in this case is Ford Motor Company. So basically, presumably, if Ford Motor Company has defaulted, its bonds are going to be selling well below par, and you get the right to sell them for par. And in the example here, you get the right to sell $10 million par value of bonds for par. Now, something, as I say, you'll be hearing a lot about this evening is this thing known as a credit default swap, a credit default spread, or a credit default swap spread. And that is the 90 basis points. That is how much you pay for protection. Okay, and that's likely to depend on who the reference entity is and how long you're buying protection for. So if you're buying protection against a AAA reference entity such as Japan, I think Japan, actually whether Japan is still AAA or not, I'm not quite sure. There are still some AAA reference entities out there. You'll pay somewhere in the region of 20 basis points a year. Okay, and then, you know, we have this pecking order of ratings. AAA is the best. AA is the next best. So you might pay 40 basis points a year for a AA, 60 basis points a year for a single A, and maybe 100 basis points a year for a triple B, and so on. So How would we value a credit default swap spread? Well, actually, sorry, a credit default swap. Well, that's pretty straightforward as it happens. All we need to do is to think about what's the expected cost and what's the expected payoff. And if we've got an existing credit default swap, then the value is just the expected payoff minus the expected cost. Because we're talking about value in a derivative, we do everything in a risk-neutral world. So what we're interested in estimating is risk-neutral probabilities of default and risk-neutral recovery rates. Okay, now I won't say anything more about that, but that's, you know, that's where the action is as far as valuing credit default swaps. It's estimating risk-neutral default probabilities and the recovery rates. Luckily, in this particular instrument, is not highly sensitive to the recovery rate. Recovery rate is the amount you recover when the guy defaults. You know, maybe it's 50 cents on the dollar, 25 cents on the dollar, or something like that. So it turns out that credit default swaps are not very, they're a little sensitive, but not very sensitive to the recovery rate, providing you use the same recovery rate in estimating default probabilities and then in valuing the deal. So you might estimate default probabilities from bond prices or other credit default swaps. So long as you are consistent in the recovery rate you use, you find that the answer you get at the end of the day for the value of a credit default swap is not very sensitive to the recovery rate. So just to, so let's say we'll be talking a lot about the credit default swap spread, the CDS spread. So the, just to repeat what I said earlier, the N-year CDS spread is the premium for which an N-year CDS has a value of zero. So you're sort of saying, how much, if I want to buy 5-year protection against Ford, how much do I pay? If you pay 90 basis points a year, we're assuming our example, then you are entering into a deal which at the time you enter into it has a value of zero to you, of course. Time goes by, Ford might get a better, become a worse credit risk or a better credit risk, and so that deal may turn out to have a positive or a negative value. Okay, so that was an example of the simplest type of deal. No default correlation, no optionality. Another type of deal is a first-to-default basket credit default swap. And this is where we have a basket of reference entities, not just Ford, but maybe, you know, 20 other reference entities in the basket, similar to a regular credit default swap, except that we've got all these different reference entities, and there's a payoff when the first one defaults. And then the deal's over. Okay, so you basically, whereas with a regular credit default swap, you've only got one chance of getting a payoff. Here, there are 20 reference entities that might default and lead to a payoff, but you only get the payoff once. This deal, it turns out, is quite dependent on default correlation. Basically, if all the entities in your basket are, you know, companies that are tied in with the automotive business situated in Detroit, the default correlation is likely to be quite high. Whereas if there are entities which come from all over the world in all sorts of different industries, the default correlation will be relatively low. And this will affect the value of a first-to-default basket CDS. So it turns out that first-to-default basket CDSs, from the point of view of the buyer, are most valuable if the default correlation is low. Now, one complication in valuing these first-to-default basket CDSs is that we have to have a metric for the default correlation. And, you know, this is where you think, well, I understand everything there is to know about correlation. You know, using correlations for the last 20, 30 years or whatever. But actually, this is, the regular correlation measure doesn't really work in this situation because we're talking about either the default happens or it doesn't happen. It's a binary variable. And so we've got to sort of invent some correlation metric. The one that the rating agencies tend to use when they publish default correlation statistics is the one that I've listed here, that you take two variables and you say the variable equals one, you've got these two companies, A and B. The first variable equals one if company A defaults during a certain time period. You've got to specify the time period, and zero otherwise. And then you have a similar variable for company B. And then you have the regular formula for correlation to calculate the, to give you this correlation metric. Okay, so it's the correlation is just the it's just the regular correlation formula between variables which are defined that way. But of course, that correlation measure does depend on, is different for different times for different values of t. And also, it's very difficult. I was talking about baskets with 20 companies. It's very difficult to extend that particular correlation measure so that it applies to, so that it's a sort of 20-dimensional correlation measure, 20 different companies. The way people tend to handle this problem is the second is to use the second default correlation measure, which is sometimes referred to as the copular approach, where you take the probability distribution of the time to default, the survival time, which is, of course, not a well-behaved normal distribution. But what you do is you transform that. You transform it on a sort of fractile by fractile basis to a normal distribution. So for each company, you take the probability distribution of the time to default, you transform it on a fractile by fractile basis to a normal distribution, and then you have functions of the survival time which are normally distributed. And then you're home and dry because we know a lot about the multivariate properties of normal distributions. So you can then easily handle correlations. There are obviously assumptions you're making when you do that, but you can easily handle correlations between 20 different companies. So that sort of emerged as, shall we say, the standard way of handling default correlation in the credit default swap market, or in the credit derivatives market, I should say. Okay, so that was an example of a deal where there was no optionality, but there was quite a heavy dependence on default correlation. Now, here we're talking about a deal where there's only one reference entity, so there's no dependence on default correlation, but there's some optionality, and as we'll be seeing in a moment, the credit default swap market has become an incredibly successful market. I'll give you some sense of that, and Alan will give you some sense of it as well when he does his presentation. But it's a market which sort of started from virtually nothing in 1997 and has now become a $1.5 trillion market. And it's a great market. This is the regular credit default swap market because it's a market which enables you to trade credit risk in much the same way as you've always traded market risk. And if you don't like your exposure to a particular company, you can use the credit default swap market, in other words, buy insurance to trade your way out of that exposure. Well, as the natural way these markets tend to go is, once the market for one thing gets really well established, you naturally start thinking about a market for options on that thing. And the options on credit default swap market is beginning to develop now. This is the way an option on a credit default swap would work. We might have a European option to buy 5-year protection on Ford for 100 basis points starting in 1 year. So in other words, we're here now and say in a year's time we have the right to buy 5-year protection on Ford for a certain spread. And then we can say, well, yeah, but what happens if Ford actually defaults during the year, the 1-year life of the option? Then this credit spread is then not defined because nobody's going to sell you protection on a company that's already defaulted. Well, it turns out that the way the deal's usually defined is the option's just knocked out in those circumstances. Okay. Well, there's some very nice maths that shows that if we assume that the credit default swap spread at option maturity conditional on no earlier default is log normal. The valuation formula for an option on a credit default swap spread is very similar to the valuation formula for a European swap option, which is a very, you know, well-established valuation formula in finance. So, and this result was first shown, I think, by a German statistician, Philipp Schönbucher, and he used some very nice, you know, for those of you here who are mathematicians, he had to introduce a new measure to prove that, which was what he called the I think it was called a survival measure or something. Okay. So, and I'd say that. So we've looked at a number of different types of credit derivatives, largely to give you a sort of sense of what this market's all about and what the different types of deals in the market are. The rest of my presentation and Alan's presentation is going to be focusing on the main market, this credit default swap market, which, you know, the sort of most basic market where you're buying protection or selling protection against a particular name. And Alan and I have been very fortunate in that a broker, GFI, who has been collecting data on credit default swap spreads since 1997, has made their database available to us. And, you know, perhaps I should just explain what a broker is for those of you who are not in the business. A broker is somebody who tries to bring buyers and sellers together. So, you know, somebody who wants to buy protection on Ford could call up a broker and say, okay, I want to buy protection on Ford at 80 basis points for 5 years, and then, you know, the broker will call up other people and say, well, where are you on Ford right now? Are you prepared to sell protection? They say, well, okay, I'll sell protection 110 basis points. So then they have, you know, a bid at 80 and an offer at 110, and you know, and then, you know, they obviously try and close the gap between the two and do a deal. So that's the data that we have, the bids and the offers on particular reference entities, particular days. And very often, of course, what you see is you start out by having a bid on a particular name, an offer on a particular name, and then they sort of become closer and closer together as the day progresses. Sometimes GFI, when they actually do a deal, they actually record the bid and the offer to be the same, and that means we know the deal was done. Sometimes actually they actually don't get around to doing that because there's a lot of other things to do once the deal's done. So you don't actually see the you're not actually sure which deals were done and which deals were not done, but you certainly see the patterns of bids and offers throughout the day. Number of quotations, this gives you an idea of the GFI are the biggest credit default swap broker, and they also have for the last 6 years won the you know, the award for being the best broker in credit default swaps. The number of quotations in this database has risen from, you know, under 5,000 a year in 1998 to over 125,000 a year in 2002. And that sort of mirrors the, you know, the growth of the market overall. Number of things you can see happening during the market, you know, the bid-offer spreads have tightened quite a bit. When, you know, because sometimes people call up the broker and quote both bids and offers, and so you see the spreads. But one of the things that's sort of most interesting is that over time, the five-year deal has become the standard deal. When you look back in 1998, you know, you see all sorts of different maturities, and I can't remember what proportion of the maturities were 5 years, but it was, I'm pretty sure it was less than 50%. But as time's gone by, 5 years has become the standard maturity for these deals. And I say that now accounts for 85% of the trades. Now, one of our objectives, I shouldn't say our only objective, one of our objectives with this database was to do the three things that are listed here. And I should point out that this was kind of one of these nice situations where, you know, there was some synergy with what Alan and I wanted to do with the database and what GFI wanted to do with the database. And so, you know, that was why, in fact, GFI were prepared to give us the database. We were Both GSI and ourselves were interested in calculating indices of credit default swap spreads. GSI's interest in calculating indices of credit default swap spreads was a commercial interest. They wanted to provide more information to their clients about where the market was, where individual names were, individual reference entities were at any given time. Our interest was to construct an index to do a number of statistical tests on this market. And Alan will be talking about those statistical tests after the break. So my role here is to talk about the construction of the indices, and then Alan's role is to talk about how we use the indices to do all sorts of interesting tests on the market. So the objective of the bit that I'm talking about is to calculate indices, and we actually divided the rating categories into three groups, because we had to combine the AAA and AA rating categories, because there just weren't enough observations in each category. So we had produced a single index for those two categories. The single A category and the triple B category, or this is the Moody's notation for the triple B category, which is BAA. There are these three rating categories, and we wanted to find get an index for where credit spreads were for each of those rating categories. That was the first objective. The second objective was to provide a mechanism for estimating what the five-year credit default swap spread was for any particular name. By name, I mean reference entity. Any particular reference entity on any particular day. Okay, even if that reference entity hadn't had any bids and offers, still wanted to estimate where that reference entity was. And thirdly, to provide a mechanism for estimating non-five-year spreads, which is more difficult, of course, because 85% of the trading is in five-year spreads. For any name on any day. Now, we're refining our names for these indices, and Alan thinks he's come up with a better name than the names I've got here, but I'm going to stick with the names I've got here. The spread change index and the spread level index. Turns out there are two different indices. I mean, when we started to get into this business of defining an index of credit spreads, we found there's some interesting properties. There's some very subtle survivor bias problems for those of you who are into this sort of research. And the survivor bias sort of can be captured by defining two different indices. One is the spread change index. I'm calling it the spread change index. And this, what this index does is measures the average percentage change in spreads for names in a particular rating category. And the key point is that the names are, you know, you're looking at this time and this time, and the name is in the rating category at both times. Okay, so it's kind of a conditional index, because we're talking about how much does the rating of a company change given that the company over the period of time you're looking at has stayed in that particular rating category. Okay, and then there's a spread level index where we don't really think about whether the company has been in this rating category or not in the past. We're just interested in where on average rating is for the particular credit default swaps are for a particular rating category. Now, some people like this analogy, some people don't, but I got a couple of visuals with an analogy here, which is considering the problem of constructing an annual index for the ages of people in the United States. I guess I could have changed this to Canada for this presentation. But, okay, so we're interested in constructing an index for the ages of people in Canada, shall we say. Okay, so one alternative would be to start the index at 100 and let the index increase between the end of 1 year and the end of the next year by the average increase in the ages of people who are alive at both times. Think about that, okay? That's a pretty simple index. Okay? that index is going to go 100, 101, 102, 103, 104. Right? If you just focus, this is the conditional index. This is the index conditional on the fact that the person was alive at the beginning of the year as well as the end of the year. Okay? So another alternative would just be to measure the average age of the population each year. Now, as I say, the first index is just growing at the rate of 1 per year. The second index is probably growing as well, but it's certainly not growing at the rate of 1 per year. And the two indices that that first index is analogous to this spread change index. It's saying that given the company is, well, we could call it alive, but what we actually mean is in the rating category at the beginning of the period and at the end of the period, what's been the change? Okay. And we don't worry, we're not sort of getting into births and deaths, which is companies arriving in the rating category for the first time and companies leaving the rating category. And then the second index is analogous to the spread level index. So the second index takes account of births and deaths in calculating the average age, and the first index looks only at people who are initially alive and stay alive. And similarly, for our rating, for calculating our indices of credit default swap spreads, we have these two indices, which are the spread change index, which is the index of the changes in the spread, conditional on the fact that the company stays in the index. Stays in the rating category. And you know what you tend to find, if we look at, for example, at the single A rating category, companies that stay in that rating category tend to get worse over time, but there are new companies entering in at the top, and then the companies that are getting worse sort of eventually leave at the bottom. So what you find is that for the A rating category, the spread change index tends to go up over time, because the companies that stay in that rating category do tend to get worse on average. But the spread level index may not be going up over time, because the average spread for an A-rated company may be staying exactly the same. There are these relatively good companies that are being downgraded from AA, and the poor companies are being ejected at the bottom into BBB, and on average the spread may be staying the same. So that's the effect we're capturing with these two indices. Okay. So what do we do in terms of collecting the data? We have these bids and offers for a particular maturity on a particular name on a particular day. So first of all, we impose each day, we calculate the maximum bid and the minimum offer that's recorded. Sometimes those will be the same because a trade was done on that day, but sometimes there are trades done and GFI never got around to recording them, even though they recorded all the bids and offers leading up to the trade. So basically what we did was calculate halfway between the maximum bid and the minimum offer and assume that that was where the market was for that particular company on that particular day, or that particular reference entity on that particular day. So we had to have both a bid and an offer, and we also imposed a condition that the bids and the offer had to be reasonably close together. Won't go into what the conditions were, but we did have a condition on that. And first of all, we focused on calculating. It turned out we had to calculate both sorts of indices: the spread change index, that's the conditional index, and the spread level index, which is this unconditional index. And you'll see why in a moment. Not all names traded on all days. We had to somehow calculate this index, knowing that we've got by trades I mean provide observations on all days. Okay, these observations of both bids and offers. So, you look at Ford Motor Company may, in fact, have bids and offers today. And so you can calculate an observation for the Ford Motor Company today. When did you last calculate an observation for the Ford Motor Company? It might have been yesterday, it might be 2 days ago, 3 days ago. We don't want to throw Ford Motor Company out just because there wasn't an observation yesterday. Okay, so we have to develop some way of computing this index that's that allows for situations where, maybe the last observation we had on the particular names that provide us with observations today, the last observation was, 2, 3, 4, 5 days old. And for that, we need a model and do some sort of maximum likelihood analysis. We tried 6 different models in the course of the research, and the model we wound up with was this model. Given the way the time's going, I'm not going to say too much about the model. It's actually easiest to understand this model in terms of the sort of related model that hasn't got the logs, which would be the model Xij equals Aj plus Ci plus Ej. What we'd be saying is that this is the spread, and the spread has a bit that's related to the index, and then there's some constant amount that we add or subtract to the index, and then there's an error term. But actually, it turns out it works better if you do it in logs. Once the index has been calculated up to day n minus 1, the model enables a maximum likelihood estimate for the index on day n to be calculated in a straightforward way. Straightforward way, you don't have to make estimates of standard deviations and that sort of thing, which sort of tend to make life difficult. Okay, so here were the results for our spread change index, and I'm showing the results from April 2001 to May 2002. I could show it to you for a lot longer period, but it's kind of more interesting to see it when the market had really got well established and there was lots of trading. This was the September of the 11th effect, and okay, this is the top-rated companies, okay, the AAAs and AAs. This is the single A-rated companies, and this is the BBB companies. So in terms of pecking order of credit rating, these are the best credits, these are the second best credits, and these are the third best credits. So what we're seeing actually is that the September the 11th didn't have a huge effect on the really good credits. But interestingly, the effect, and actually this is true whichever model we use, all the 6 models gave this result. The single A credits were much more affected by events like September the 11th than the BBB credits. Okay, and you can see that by the increase there versus the increase there. Okay, so that's the spread change index. The thing about the spread change index is that the numbers themselves don't mean anything. Okay, it's what we did with the spread change index was actually start the index at 100 at the beginning of 2001. So all of these 3 were at 100. And the reason I don't show you the first 3 months is because, it takes a little while for the index to actually initialize itself properly and that sort of thing. But You actually always start the index at 100 3 months before the period of time you're really interested in. It turns out in the way we're doing it. Now, of course, what GFI are interested in, and it turns out what we're interested in for our research, is an index where the level of the index reflects the level of credit default swap spreads. And so this brings us on to the spread level index. And so the question is, how do we calculate the spread level index, which is just asking where on average were spreads for a particular rating category? And one thing to do would just be to look at all the observations we have for the particular rating category on each day and just build the index. You know, so we say, well, the average was 70 basis points that day and 83 basis points that day and so on. But it turns out the index is too volatile there because, you know, yesterday maybe we had an observation on WorldCom, today we didn't, and so yesterday was sort of, you know, peaked way up compared with today. So it turns out that what works really well is to supplement the actual observations. Remember, an observation is where we've got both the bid and the offer and they're sufficiently close together. We supplement those observations with what we call pseudo-observations, which are observations that are calculated using the spread change index. So, for example, we may not have an observation on Ford Motor Company today, but we might have had an observation on Ford Motor Company 10 days ago. And maybe the spread change index has changed 10%, just to make life easy, from 10 days ago to today. So maybe what we observed was the Ford Motor Company was 90 10 days ago, and the spread change index, and it's been in the same credit rating the whole time, and the spread change index has changed, has gone up by 10%. So what would we expect Ford Motor Company to be today? We'd expect it to be 99 basis points, 10% higher. So that's what we do. And that gives us the spread level index, which here's the spread level index for the three rating categories. So this is the best rating category, the next best, and the worst. So again, you can see the September the 11th effect there. And remember, you know, you may look at this diagram and say this picture is not exactly the same as the picture in the previous one that I showed you, but it's not the same thing. This is the unconditional index, and the other one is the conditional index. But this has got two advantages over the other one. Not only is it unconditional, but also the actual level of the index means something. Okay, and this is what distinguishes what we're doing here from what you might do when you're constructing, say, an index for the S&P 500, because the index for the S&P 500, the number doesn't actually mean anything. But here, the number actually means something. It is actually, you know, on average, spreads for triple Bs were 120 basis points on that day. Okay. Running out of time here, but the other thing we wanted to do was to estimate spreads for individual names. And the five-year spread for a name can be estimated quite simply from the most recent observation on that name and the change in the spread level, and a change in the spread change index, sorry. And I gave you that example with Ford. You know, if you had an observation on Ford 10 days ago and the spread change index has gone up 10%, then the pseudo observation today, which is your estimate, is 10% higher. For non-5-year spreads, as I say, we haven't got a lot of data to work with for non-5-year spreads, and I think this is an endemic problem in this industry. You know, how do you get a whole term structure of spreads when nearly all the trading's in 5-year deals? The best we were able to do was to assume a linear relationship between a non-5-year spread and the 5-year spread. And it's actually, you know, may sound a rather simplistic model, but actually it's not too bad. And then we look at our non-5-year observations, and we use a regression analysis where the weights assigned to observations decrease exponentially as we move back through time. And in fact, the way it works is that the weight assigned to one observation n days ago is 99% of the weight assigned to an observation n minus 1 days ago. It's like an exponentially weighted moving average kind of arrangement, except we're doing it within the structure of a regression analysis. And that enables us to sort of keep tabs on what the slope, the slope of the credit default spread curve is doing. And you know, this is what we got for the parameter A for the different rating categories. Actually, maybe that's a good time to stop. I don't know. Maybe could take one or two questions, do you think, or?